Welcome to Home Space and Reason, a podcast about creating a home that thrives.
Hi there, I'm Christina Browning, your host.
If you know your home could be so much more than it is, I discuss home functionality, aesthetics, and automation. I'm a realtor in Portland, Oregon, and a home functionality coach. I geek out on every subject imaginable regarding your home and yard, challenging you to think of your space differently to get the most out of every square foot. I pose questions for you to think through about your space and your reason. This podcast is all positive, offering you virtual fist bumps and celebrating every win. Remember, there's no such thing as perfect, but you can still aim for your best every day. Join me on social media by searching for the handle Space and Reason. In this episode, let's discuss the life story of Grammy Award-winning rapper Sir Mix-a-Lot through the lenses of where he's lived. Wealth brings an extra layer of intrigue for me because you aren't limited by cost. Instead, you're only limited by your imagination, and in theory, your space more closely reflects your priorities. If money is no object, it's fun to see where people spend and where they reserve their spend. In an article by Business Insider, which I'll link in the show notes, billionaire Warren Buffett's home is pictured. Situated in a quiet neighborhood in Omaha, Nebraska, he bought the house for $31,500 in 1958. It's now worth an estimated $652,000. It's 6,570 square feet, has 5 bedrooms and 2.5 baths. Fences and security cameras guard the property, obviously. Why hasn't he moved to a more extravagant home, given that he is one of the world's richest men? He said, "I'm happy there. I'd move if I thought I'd be happier somewhere else." Happiness can't be bought. Happiness is derived from the ways in which you spend your time and the people you surround yourself with. And so much can be learned from hearing about where a person has lived over the course of their lifetime.
I was actually 1963. We were living at the Rainier Vista apartments. Then we did a lot of bouncing around, a lot of moving, and we ended up in the Bryant Manor, which is really where, you know, that's the stuff I remember, because by that time I was about 11, 12, somewhere in there. Yeah.
So when I think back to my childhood house, in 1976, it was the bicentennial year of the United States. And so there were eagles on everything. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember that. Yep.
And so I remember the wallpaper in our like entryway, hallway, whatever area was all like green and gold eagles. Did you guys have any of that sort of vibe going on?
No, we had what I remember. Around the bicentennial stuff was all these commercials during cartoons and stuff. You know, they'd have Roosevelt Franklin, what you say? It was all a bunch of kind of subtle political, you know, I won't say brainwashing, but education, put it that
way.
Yeah,
like U.S. fact, rah-rah. Yeah.
Right, right.
Hilarious. Yeah. So who did you live there with at that time when you were 11?
Me and my mom.
So tell me, at that time when you were that young, as far as homes go, now I've heard a lot about cars because that's your jam, but as far as homes go, what was your idea of wealth when you were really little, as far as houses?
I was going to say it had nothing to do with houses. You know, I always thought it was cars, but I realized later that it wasn't. You know, I always had the, I had never seen or met a rich person by that time in my life. So I just, everything I saw on TV, you know, Wayne Manor, when I watched Batman, you know, stuff like that, that was my idea of wealth.
I think everyone has a different perspective of wealth. And so that doesn't necessarily mean rich. It just could mean well off.
Right.
And we're all little. So when our bodies are littler, our vision of what is big may not even be that big. Like, I think I grew up in a real big house. Well, when I drove past as a grown up, that was not big.
Yeah, that just happened to me. I was explaining where I lived to a friend of mine. I was doing an interview, doing a podcast, as a matter of fact, and they wanted to get a picture, although we couldn't walk in the apartment because they're knocking them down and getting ready to make condos. That's kind of normal now. But anyway, when he looked at it, he was shocked. He said, "You lived on that third floor?" I said, "Yeah, I lived on a third floor apartment." And it was just me and my mom, and he couldn't believe it, that it was so small.
Do you remember it being big? Yeah.
Not really. I don't remember it being small either. I remember all I did was I'd come home, drop off my books, go outside and play basketball.
Yeah.
So, yes, only thing I did in the house was sleep and homework.
Yeah, yeah. So, how long did you live there? Through what age?
Through high school. So probably when I was 19, we moved out to the south end of Seattle. So, yeah.
And then was that a house or was that another apartment?
That was another apartment. Another apartment.
Okay.
Yep.
And your mom is she a nurse this whole time?
Yep. Yep. Okay. She was an LPN and at various places and she was a tough lady. You know, I miss her, but she would carry her 38 to the bus stop every morning. So she was pretty tough.
So let's yeah. fast forward to when you bought the house out in Auburn. So when you and I met in the early 90s, you already owned that home. So I don't know the story of when you were actually shopping for that. So what was your criteria? What were you looking to buy?
I wanted a space that I could do outside stuff in because I have a hobby that I'm not going to talk about, but it is something I do outside. It's not a distillery or growing weed, but it's something I do that I keep kind of to myself, but you know what it is, but nobody else does. And I needed that space. So I went out and looked for acreage first. Once I found the acreage, I wanted to see what kind of house was on it. And many times it was like farmy and cows walking around. And I waited. It took me about a year and a half to find something because I wasn't in a rush, actually. So when I finally found something, I jumped on it.
Well, so tell me, when you bought that place, I feel like you added that whole studio and that vocal area on. Did you not?
I did. I added it on. It was nothing there. I literally added a room on and added the studio, and everything in that studio had nothing to do with the house. It had everything to do with the studio. If it did not sound right, I didn't want it.
So did you actually pour concrete, like a foundation to add that?
Yeah, I poured a slab under it. And then when I put the subwoofers in, I didn't want it to sit on that same slab because you get that vibration. So what I did is I put these big steel poles that ran down into the dirt.
Like rebar.
Yeah, no. These things were big columns, kind of 4x4, 8x8 or something like that. And I put all my subs on that. When the walls start to shake, you think you have more bass than you do, and you have a tendency to EQ songs differently. Mm-hmm. And so I realized that was happening. So I said, okay, we're going to put these in here. And that studio is where most of my hits were born.
So the house initially had, I was trying to remember, a four-car garage?
Yeah, three-car garage was attached at the time that I bought it.
And then you added five?
Yep, I added five. I added five more garages and a basketball court. Man, keep in mind, I had no kids, right? a basketball court. Wow.
You were out there on occasion.
Every now and then, washing cars. That was about it.
Exactly. I don't know how many you had when you moved in there. Did your car count exceed your garage count when you bought the house?
No. I had just kind of run into some money. Things were starting to change. And I had two cars. So I put those away. And then, of course, the big one hit. And when baby got back, blew up, and I was still immature, I bought every car I could find. I'm serious.
It was part of your image. It was absolutely who you were.
Yeah, it ended up being that. It ended up being that because I wasn't a rapper that bought limos and poser cars. I actually drive mine. I wasn't a guy that take the Lamborghini and use it when I did interviews. Nope. I drove that thing on a Tuesday in the rain. Wouldn't matter.
I know the story, but I want you to share it. Tell me the story of the fish tank you put in.
I don't know what made me get into fish tanks. There was a guy named Jerome, and I went in his place, and I saw this big red-tailed catfish. And that thing had a mouth like a whale. And I said, I want that fish, blah, 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 blah. Worst thing I ever did, for multiple reasons. I ended up with another fish called an arowana. I had one called a paku or something like that. Needless to say, the catfish ate all the other fish and ended up being about 4 feet long.
Do you remember when it cracked? I was there. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah, I remember. That tank busted. We saved the fish, put another tank in, and the thing got even bigger. Everything I put in it, I tried to put bigger fish in with them, and he just ate them all. So I ended up taking that after I flooded out my house when it broke a second time.
Your living room was long, and there was a room that ran parallel to it. And it was a smaller room. Originally, wasn't that like a little office or something that you had in there before you did the fish stuff?
Yeah, the people that sold it to me, they used it for an office.
Okay.
Of course, at that time, I wasn't doing my own accounting.
So you took out a picture frame sized hole, like high up off the floor, like 2-3 feet up off the floor, made a giant long rectangle in the wall.
Yeah.
And that thing was probably 6 feet long, would you say?
Yeah, I had to order it. I tried to get one made here. And the first one I did was, it was already starting to crack when they got it halfway filled up. So they took that one out and they brought another one in that was 1.5 inches thick. Came from San Diego. That one did not break, but the other one did.
Oh my! And it was like 4 feet tall. And I don't remember what the depth was, but that's a lot of water.
It was big. I mean, like I said, when that first one broke, I had to throw all my carpet away. I mean, that's how bad it was.
Did insurance cover that?
Nope.
Oh my gosh.
Because I didn't tell them about the tank. If I did, they probably wouldn't have insured it anyway.
Holy buckets. At what point did you think it was time to move and why?
That's easy. That house, as you probably know, was really a place I stayed in between tours. It never even felt like a home. It was more like a hotel that I could sleep in anytime I wanted to. You know, that's kind of how I treated that home. But, you know, I didn't want anything gaudy anymore. I grew out of that real quick.
So where were you at with your vehicle count at this point when you say, I'm done with this house and I'm shopping? Because I can't imagine the conversation with your realtor.
Well, I got rid of a bunch of them. I kept a Lamborghini. I got rid of 3 Porsches. I got rid of the Ferrari Testarossa. When I moved over here, all I had was my dailies, my SUVs, and my Lamborghini. And then when I got here, I bought an Audi S6, and I also bought a Porsche 911 Turbo S.
How does one go house shopping when you have that many cars to house? Are you looking for, again, property to build or a house that already has a 4-car garage, for example, and then you add on? Or are you looking for that much storage too deep?
Well, you know, actually, I had almost given up looking because everything I found was I had a next door neighbor. I mean, you can't do loud music and have a big antenna and all that stuff. You can't do that next door to somebody. So I gave up. So one day I'm outside washing my car and this guy comes by and he says, are you the rap guy? I said, yeah, why? He said, I got a house you might be interested in seeing.
Oh.
Yeah, out of nowhere. And I said, okay, where's it at? And he goes, it's less than a mile away. And he described it and he told me something that was completely stupid. He said, it's got a 40-foot indoor pool. I'm like, and everybody that lives in the Northwest knows that that adds no value to your home at all. Not here. I said, you know what? And then he told me it had a basketball court upstairs. I said, who puts a basketball court upstairs?
How bizarre.
So I said, I just wanted to see it just
for fun. Yeah.
Yeah. So I drive around the block and
100%. I would be like, let's go.
Get there. And I don't know how I ever missed this house. But it was exactly when I got inside of it, I knew what I was going to do immediately. I knew the pool had to go. That was going to be where my studio is. That basketball court ended up being my master bedroom. So I took all that stuff out, just took it all out. It took about almost a year for me to move in, actually.
And so at what point do you list the property where you moved from?
The first day I moved into here, I put that property up for sale immediately, you know, and it sold pretty quick because that by the time the market was coming back. So this is around 2006. So when the market started to come back, that's when I put it up for sale.
Well, then I had a lake. Like, that's so attractive.
Yeah, that was a pond with snakes in it. Okay, it had frogs and geese pooping all over the place.
All right. Yeah. Well, it wasn't, it could have been fantastic. y'all didn't keep it up necessarily, but it was natural.
Yeah, that's the problem, is that it was natural.
So I was going to ask which was more important, the garage or the house, but you just kind of answered that question. Like, the whole thing seemed to work. How many spaces did this house have for cars?
Only three.
Wow.
Yep, only three, because I that's all I brought with me was those three cars. And I parked my SUVs in the back. So three cars inside, actually two cars inside, three trucks outside.
And so tell me how your priorities have shifted from the time you sold that original spot, that original estate you lived at for so long, and when you were looking for the next spot. Like, what was different about your values?
Oh, fiscal literacy. That was the biggest difference, is that I realized, okay, this is getting boring. At that point, I started to stack. And I cut deals a lot differently. I didn't base my income on touring anymore. So touring used to be about 60% of my income. Now touring is less than 10% of my income. Licensing and stuff like that became number one for me.
Working smarter, not harder.
Yeah.
So tell me about the home that you're living in. You said, I knew what I was going to do as soon as I walked in.
Oh, wow. Yeah. As soon as he showed me the pool, he said, yeah, you guys are going to love this, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just, at that point, he was just background noise. I wasn't even listening to that stuff because I knew it. I looked, I said, this is where my mixer's going to go. This is where my analog gear's going to go. The digital stuff goes over here, microphone right there. I knew I turned it into three rooms. It had my main room, which I'm sitting in right now. Then I have a room in between that I tracked rock bands in for the first year that I had it. Now that just is a room for excess equipment.
So once upon a time when we worked together, you had problems with being able to fit a drum kit in any studio space. So you have that capacity now?
Oh yeah. That's why I got it from your brother. Your brother came in like, oh, I'd never thought about this. Right. So I bought a bunch of mics and all that stuff. And then I recorded one rock band, and that was it.
Fascinating. So do you remember that? Of course you remember that giant original board way back, you know, before technology advanced so much. And I would imagine the technology now takes a lot less square footage than it did then. So how has the studio space been utilized differently? Because I would imagine what you needed then is massively different in size, meaning smaller. Now,
well, you know, some stuff got smaller and some stuff didn't exist, which means you're taking up more space. So I'll give you an example. So my mixer now is no longer actually a mixer. It's really a controller, right? There's no sound that passes through the mixer, but it's still tactile. You still have hands on, you still see the knobs have the writing on them and everything, but not on the knobs. Actually, it just comes up on small screens that reside all over this mixing board. What's happened lately in music is two things. One is people who are running professional studios are going back to a lot of analog gear because what we're missing sonically is the transformers, the tubes. Those sounds, those units actually had sound and we didn't appreciate it until we lost it. So everybody's
the tactile.
Yeah, everybody's buying them now because the sound is so warm. All you got to do is pass through it and it sounds different. It's pretty interesting that I took that for granted. Also, this is the one where I spent a lot of money and I haven't seen any benefits, any rewards yet, but I will. I got a 714 surround sound system, right? So Apple said you can't even put music on their platform if you don't have Dolby Atmos system. And I think that it may be a waste of money at some point. I put over 80 grand into it. And to be honest with you, I think the way people are using it is backwards. I think people are trying to make movies out of songs. To me, the way it should be used is as a sound effect. And what I mean by that, I don't want to hear my guitar player behind me, my drummer's in front of me, another guitar player's on the ceiling. I don't want to hear that. I want to use it as an effect. So the body of the music stays in front of me and left, right, and center. But the other things pan around me, which I think will add more interesting effects to songs as opposed to turning them into, you know, basically
mini movies.
Mini movies or demos for, you know, some theater or something.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting about you is you fully wired that original studio. And so when people talk about retro gear, there's probably very few people in the United States that can actually speak to it at the granular level that you can, having had done that way back in the late 80s, early 90s, because you know literally why that tactile sound sounds that way. And did you keep that gear so that you can recreate that these days?
No, you know, I actually got rid of the gear because I thought, oh, I don't even need this anymore. This sounds great. But I remember after I did the Mac Daddy album, and that one was done through Analog Gear. I did the album after that. That was recorded through Analog Gear. But when I got to Daddy's home, I started working on that album. And I'm like, it just sounded sterile. I mean, it's hard to explain it. It sounded one-dimensional. There was no depth, no body, no thunder. It was, you had to manufacture it and made it sound fake. So what I realized, I got a friend of mine named Vic, who's way smarter than me. And he told me it's not just the tubes, it's more the transformers in the old gear. So I immediately went on a buying spree. I spent thousands of dollars bringing that stuff back. And boy, it sounds way better. Now I'm just itching to mix up stuff now. So
yeah, well, you remember being out with the DAT recorder in the pond, and I had those thigh waist high rubber boots. Remember we were recording
the noises for Bumposaurus. I remember that well. Yeah, the big splash. And I just took that when you dropped a big rock in there, if I'm not mistaken, and I recorded that, and then I slowed it down so it sounded like, so you sound like Godzilla or something. You know, it was pretty cool.
So cool. Well, you've always geeked out on that kind of stuff, so it doesn't surprise me at all that this is interesting and fascinating to you. So I read an interview in Rolling Stone magazine, and you said that the presidential suite at the Aria Hotel in Vegas was the inspiration for your shower.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
Tell me more.
Oh my God. There's a presidential suite that they gave me. It was a Tuesday night. So let's not think I came in there and spent $10,000 and spend one night. It had this big shower, two rain heads up top. It had these hard firing, three of those on each side, so six of them total. I mean, they would blow your facial expression off. They hit so hard. And one handheld one that had three or four different settings on that. I love showers, by the way. I had a ball searching for all that stuff. I mimicked what I saw in the Aria. Of course, it was the budget version, but it was pretty nice.
So tell me about the aesthetics.
The shower itself, what it looked like?
Yeah, is it like creamy? Is it like masculine and dark? Is it like what's the vibe?
You know, I think it's more masculine and dark, but it doesn't look like a guy did it. It looks like, you know, there was a female touch, but it kind of wasn't. But I don't really like macho stuff. Like, I hate guys that have like nuts and bolts for doorknobs. No, I don't do that. But it's pretty, I mean, put it this way. Every time a girl's ever saw it or a woman's ever saw it, they always say, oh, that's nice. Who did that? And I take that as a compliment.
Yeah, like, you know? Me.
Yeah.
Tell me, I know that you're a gadget guy and I know that you enjoy technology. Tell me about your house related tech. Like, do you have a smart home system? What smart stuff do you have and like versus have and would not recommend?
I had the smart stuff at my old house. I had all these little lights that would click on by themselves. Now, keep in mind, this is back in the 80s. So that was high tech back then. I hated it. I couldn't stand it. So I didn't do a lot of high tech because of one other reason. I have a hobby that emits a lot of RF, a lot of radio frequency interference. So when you bring too much digital in, kaboom. So I intentionally did not put a lot of digital stuff in here. A lot of analog, but not a lot of digital.
What is your favorite thing about your current house where you're living right now?
My bed, my shower, my studio in reverse order.
Interesting.
I have a lot of big rooms that do it. My great room is huge. It's 30-foot ceiling in there, but 30-foot ceiling is sexy until you realize it's cold because all the heat rises.
Totally.
Yeah, so yeah, the great room is, I go in there and in the winter, I put on a sweatshirt and watch the big screen, you know?
Let's talk about gates.
Yeah.
One thing that was necessary in the estate that you had when baby got back was a big deal, was the gate at the entrance of your driveway. And to me, that's one of those things that signals some wealth. Doesn't have to be a lot, but the average person does not have a giant gate at the end of their driveway. What's the thing in a home that signals wealth to you?
You know, what's funny is that gate, well, you know why I got it. Because if you remember, people used to go by and yell stuff, throw stuff at the house, you know, so I just, you know, trying to do pranks and stuff. So that's the reason I got the gate. And same thing at this house. Although this one, my driveway is almost a quarter mile. So if you want to walk up that driveway, take a chance.
You don't know what's going to be at the other end of it.
Come on up. Yeah, we welcome you. But I never did it because I thought it signified wealth. I really did it for the real reason. I didn't want people coming in, you know, because.
Tell me about the coolest home you've ever been in.
I have a friend of mine that's a billionaire, right? And
does he live in L.A.? I think I know who it is.
He has a place in Vegas. He has a place in Reno. He has a place everywhere. He's good friend, close friend. But he bought a condo for, now keep in mind, he already has a massive house. It's 50,000 square feet or something like that. Just him and his wife. But he also has a condo that's really, 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 really nice. $16 million condo. Absolutely beautiful. And of course, even though I thought it was beautiful when he bought it, he gutted it and then did it his way. And you talk about car collection. Whew.
How do you have a car collection in a condo?
Oh, that's not where he lives. He has another place in Bellevue.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And not Bellevue. What's that rich place out in Bellevue? And the condo is something that he does, you know, because his wife likes it.
How lovely.
I love the guy, though. He's one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. He's very modest. But his car collection, he sold a car at auction for $48 million, one car. It was a Ferrari GTO.
Tell me, and I can take this out of the edit, but tell me about Rick Rubin's house.
Rick Rubin's house, I didn't go to the. See, I thought I was at the Rick Rubin house, which was kind of more in the Hollywood area. No, he has one out there on a beach. That's the one he didn't let me see. And I'm kind of jealous that I didn't get to see it. I see Pharrell was there. You know, all the other artists were there, but I didn't get that. So I don't know.
That's the kind of show I want to do. But we just go look at houses. Well, I think that there is some level of not too much, not too on trend, not too big. If it's too big, you got to clean it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some happy medium there where you just, you have enough.
Mine is too big.
It's comfortable.
Mine is too big, but I knew that coming in. I got such a good deal on it. I mean, this thing has gone up. I don't even want to say it. It's like, I'm ashamed it's gone up so much. But I bought it when the market crashed, you know, in 2005, 6, something like that. But what I did, I said, it's big, it's weight, it's 11, well, it's more than, it used to be 11,000. I added one room. So it's probably, let's just call it 11,000 plus. But there is no stupid room. Well, there's a stupid room. My office is stupid because it never gets cleaned up. But for the most part, every room is used in a way that makes some sense.
So there's no wasted space.
Try to keep it logical. I got to sell it one day, right?
So, well, I mean, in theory, are you done? Are you done house shopping?
Oh, I'm through. I'm good here. Yeah, you know what I did do? I did do a massive shop outside.
Oh, tell me more.
Boy, because I got, you know, well, you know my hobby I had. I used to always be into electronics and making stuff and building stuff. You know, I watched other people get older around me. And I noticed that what made them, I'm doing air quotes, old, was the fact that they had nothing to do. They literally stopped doing anything because they didn't have hobbies. They didn't have passions, nothing. And I realized, okay, let me keep my electronic stuff going because I love electronics and I'm going to stick with that to the day I check out of here. Because if I don't, you just sit here and dig in your nose and watch TV all day. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, well, you've always been really active and I've never known you to ever say, I'm bored. Never, ever, ever. You have so much to do that you can't get it done in one day. That's the conversation.
I had COVID twice, right? So the thing that trips me out is when I had COVID, I couldn't do much. And I started losing weight and I was scared that it was bad. It probably was bad. But once I got over the second time, I made up my mind, I'm going to stay here. So I've stopped. Well, you know me. I stopped drinking all soda in 2003. I changed the way I eat and everything, and I lost like almost 100 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we only get one body, so yep. That's good.
Yeah, I got half of my old one.
Wow. What? Tell me about the shop. Do you have like workbenches in there? Is it that kind of shop?
It's pretty big, about 1,600 square feet, but it's already full. I mean, I got guys ordering stuff they want me to build for them, and you know, I bought a, now this is going to sound crazy because I know you were into the art stuff. So I bought myself a laser and I mean a big one. I could sit here right now and make cabinets for people that manufacture stuff and pay for it. That's how easy it is to cut on it. It is totally different than my plasma machine. I got rid of that thing. You had it, you'd cut something in 3 minutes and then you had to sand it for 2 hours. But with this one, you cut it, done. I mean, it is incredible. I love it.
So tell me about your lighting.
Lighting.
You got to be able to see.
Lighting, especially in here in the studio. I have a problem with, they call, quote unquote, I'm doing air quotes again, daylight. So I went back to yellow. I mean, kind of the yellowish light.
Warm.
Because it's easier on my eyes. But that bright white stuff, you close your eyes and you can still see the light. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
Yeah, so I pulled all of that out of my house and went to the yellowish white.
Do you have dimmers?
Yep, I got dimmers in the studio because sometimes I don't know why songs sound different and people dim the lights.
I think I know why.
Why is that?
Because you're taking the sight off the table.
Yeah.
So you're making that less important, which heightens your hearing, in my opinion.
It does. Your senses are all like that. Yeah. You close your eyes, your ears get more sensitive. You close your ears, your eyes get more sensitive. So I agree with you on that.
For any of you listening to the Home Space and Reason podcast for the first time, welcome. There are few things in life as universal and relaxing as sitting around an open fire pit on a crisp, starry night, sharing stories, watching the smoke rise, and listening to the crackle of the fire. If you've considered adding a fire pit to your yard, let's deep dive into size, aesthetic, functionality, and portability with special guest Mike Bertelston of the Cowboy Cauldron Company. No matter if you own a tiny home or a luxurious estate, enjoy episode 38 of the Home Space and Reason podcast, all about the backyard fire pit, available anywhere you listen and linked in the show notes. Make sure you subscribe so new episodes will automatically be added to your queue. It's one less thing to think about. Hey, who out there knows Mila and Ashton? I'd love to do an interview just like this about their home with them and Reese Witherspoon. I have questions about her homes, what attracts her to them, and let's geek out on the renovations. So much can be learned from hearing about where a person has lived over the course of their lifetime and the things they do to their homes to make them feel just right. So if you know somebody who knows somebody, tell them to connect with me. Who do you know that was a fan of Mix-a-Lot? Share this episode with them and help me spread the word. If you happen to live in the greater Metro Portland, Oregon area and you'd like to hire me as your home functionality coach or as your realtor, reach out to me through social media or my website, spaceandreason.com. Also connect with me by clicking the link in the show notes. Thanks for sitting in on this conversation about creating a home that thrives, and I'll meet you back here for the next episode.